Hour one, that was about visitors. Visitors from far off. Beings that slip through our skies, our oceans, our borders of belief. They're intelligent, coordinated, and in their own way, very patiently observing us. But there's another side to the unknown, a darker, more primal side, a side that doesn't travel in metallic craft or hover above missile silos, a side that looks at us not with curiosity, but with something older, something wilder, something that belongs to the forests, the marshes, the mountains, the depths of the oceans, lochs and lakes, and the night sky. Hour one dealt with intellect. Hour two deals with instinct. These are the stories people whisper and then stop halfway, realizing how close they came to something that just shouldn't exist at all. Stories told by hunters, police officers, fishermen, pilots, teachers, scientists, hikers, hell, entire families. People with reputations they did not want to risk, all describing creatures that move in ways no known animal moves and disappear in ways that no human should be able to. Tonight, we step off the road, we walk into the woods, and we wade into the water. We look up into the skies, because they don't always belong to just the birds. In this hour, it's about monsters, not folklore, not legends, but the most credible, unnerving, documented cryptid encounters ever reported. The ones that force even skeptics to lean in, swallow hard, and admit, okay, that shouldn't exist. And I gotta tell you, after more than 20 years walking this strange and winding path, after listening to thousands of trembling voices, after standing in dark places sane people avoid, people still ask me, Dave, why do you believe in creatures that sound more myth than reality? The answer? Because of these encounters, because of these people, because of these moments, the ones that stay with you, the ones that don't fade, the ones that change something to your core. So let's step in the dark together and meet the monsters that made me believe. I'm Dave Schrader. And now it's time to dig a little deeper. The night the creature came to Flatwoods, everything felt wrong, but they never knew why. It started with a streak of fire that cut across the West Virginia sky. It was low, slow, and burning hot enough that the May boys, Freddie and Eddie, swore they felt the heat on their faces. They ran home screaming for their mother, Kathleen May, tripping over each other in the dirt road as they shouted about a plane crash. Kathleen, she didn't panic. She grabbed a flashlight and went. With her boys came their friend Tommy Heyer and a young National Guardsman, Eugene Gene Lemon, who thought they might be rescuing survivors. Now, this was 1952, my friends. Put yourself into that time. Put yourself into that mindset. Just how far back in time it went, but how far we've come since then. Now, with her boys in tow and their friend Tommy Heyer and National Guardsman Gene Lemon, they ran halfway up the hill. Their excitement began to curdle, though, because the air smelled like burning metal. There was this sharp, chemical, nauseating scent that permeated the area. And the closer they got, the thicker it became. The boys gagged. Gene felt his eyes burning and watering. Then Kathleen's flashlight swept across the clearing. And that's when it caught the eyes. Huge, burning, orange eyes set in a strange hooded face. The creature towered above them. They say it was close to 10 feet tall, floating rather than standing, and its lower body hidden in rolling mist. Its claws glinted in the beam of the light. And then the hiss began. A suffocating vapor blasted towards them, hot, oily, chemically. The boys screamed. Jean stumbled backward, and Kathleen grabbed whoever she could and ran through the choking fog as the creature glided toward them, silent, except for that searing, hissing noise. In the days that followed, investigators found scorched earth, thickened witnesses, and a lingering chemical odor that could not be identified. Kathleen, she never changed her story. Neither did Gene, and neither did the boys. And the thing on that hillside, it was never seen again. But Flatwoods was only the beginning, because a year later, another winged creature appeared, and this one didn't stay hidden. We're going to talk about the Mothman. Point Pleasant, West Virginia, November 15th, 1966. The TNT plant road was silent. It was too silent, as Roger Scarberry and his wife Linda and their friends Steve and Mary Millette drove its winding path. The old bunkers loomed like concrete tombs swallowed by vines. Then Linda's voice cracked through the dark. "Roger, stop! Something's there!" Two red orbs gleamed at the edge of the road, but they weren't reflective. They glowed with an internal heat, pulsing like coals in a furnace. The creature then stepped forward, tall, gray, 7 feet at least, and behind it wings, huge, folded tight, yet ready to flex. Roger slammed the gas. The creature launched itself into the air with a single fluid movement. Linda turned to look. "It's still there," she whispered, trembling. "It's following us." And it was. No wing beats, no flapping, just a smooth predatory glide above their speeding car. 100 miles per hour, 90, 80. It stayed with them through every turn, every attempt to lose it. Only when they reached the town's bright lights did the creature bank away and vanish. The next night, someone else saw it. Then another, and then dozens of people witnessed this strange creature. Police officers, firefighters, teenagers, parents, factory workers. Hell, there were over 100+ witnesses over a year. A creature that moved through Point Pleasant like a shadow brought to life. And that wasn't even the only winged terror to walk American soil. Because decades earlier, in a small town in Iowa, people saw something even stranger. And I'm curious, friends, have you witnessed something that you've been afraid to tell your friends, your closest relatives, maybe even having trouble admitting to yourself that you witnessed? If so, I would love to hear from you. Send me an email. Share your story with me here. You can send the email to Dave@paranormal60.com. That's Dave@paranormal60.com. You don't have to include your name if you're afraid of judgment or having unwanted attention given to you. But if you want to share, this is a safe place. This is a place you can come and bring your stories, bring the examples of the strange and supernatural that you've had. And maybe you've had something you've never heard anyone else talk about. I beg you, share that story, because you never know how many other people listening around the world may be feeling just as crazy as you, just on that same ledge of not sure what to do or what to believe. But your story may open in them a feeling and a sense of relief that they're not alone, that there are strange things going on around us, and that they too have witnessed something that they can share with other people. So please, I encourage you, send your stories in to me, Dave@paranormal60.com, and we will share them on an upcoming episode. When we return, we're going to visit the Van Meter Visitor, and that's next on the Paranormal 360. It's 1903, and Van Meter wasn't the kind of place where tall tales survived long. Farmers, merchants, bankers, all practical, very sober-minded people. So when U.G. Griffith, the town's bookkeeper, arrived at work, pale and shaking, people, they took notice. It began when Griffith saw a creature perched atop the bank, a creature that he said was tall, hunched figure, with a glowing horn sprouting from its forehead, sweeping a beam of white light over the street like a searchlight. The creature leapt, silently, soaring across rooftops with unnatural ease. The next night, O.V. White, a hardware store owner, awoke to the sound of footsteps on his roof. When he opened his second-story window, the creature's glowing horn shone directly into his eyes. White fired his rifle at point-blank range, and the creature didn't even react. Later that same night, Sidney Gregg saw it hopping powerfully, unnaturally down Main Street. Then came Dr. Alcott. He heard rustling in his yard. He stepped outside, aimed his shotgun just in time to see the creature unfurl enormous wings, and it rocketed skyward. Enough was enough. The townspeople formed a posse and surrounded the abandoned mine the creature used as its refuge. What emerged is documented in multiple reports. Two creatures came out together, one large, one small, both reeking like steam engines, both launching into the sky, flapping furiously before disappearing forever. Van Meter sealed the mine the next spring, but America's beasts weren't limited to just these winged beings, because in Wisconsin, something walking around on two legs that should have been on all four was the point of our next story. For this, it's the Beast of Bray Road. Now imagine it's Halloween night, 1991. Lori Andreese, a 21-year-old nursing home worker, was driving home when she saw something hunched on the side of Bray Road. Now, at first, she thought it was a person kneeling over roadkill, but when her headlights hit it, the figure stood and turned menacingly towards her, 7 feet tall, covered in coarse brown hair, broad-shouldered, with a wolf-like appearance, very wolf-like face. But there was something wrong. It was too expressive, and it seemed very aware. And it stared at her. And that's when it came toward her car. Lori, she floored it, heart pounding as she felt the car lurch forward. But the thing lunged, striking her trunk with enough force to rock the entire vehicle. Lori didn't look back. In the months that followed, farmers reported livestock torn apart with surgical precision. Children spoke of a massive wolf man stalking their properties. And a local woman said it chased her car for over 3 miles, running on all fours faster than she'd ever seen a wolf or dog move. Believe it or not, tracks were found. Tracks that were huge and canine, but had elongated midfeet, a type of print that no wolf leaves behind. So whatever roamed Bray Road isn't a dog. It isn't exactly a man. What could this creature be? A shapeshifter? A skinwalker? Legend of Native American indigenous tribes? Or something else? A horrific being that we have yet to identify. For our next story, let's head to Massachusetts in 1977, April 21st to be exact. It was around 10 p.m. at night when 17-year-old Bill Bartlett was driving down Farm Street in Dover, Massachusetts, headlights carving a narrow tunnel through the darkness. He wasn't expecting anything unusual. He was just another teenager heading home. But as he rounded a slow bend, his headlights swept across a low stone wall. Something was perched upon it. Bill didn't understand what he was seeing at first. As a matter of fact, his brain tried to fit into categories he recognized. Was it a cat? No. A dog? No. Maybe it was just a kid in a costume. Nothing about the way it clung to those stones made sense. It was hairless. Completely. Its skin was like this pale, almost glowing in the headlights effect. Its head was enormous, bulbous actually, almost too heavy for the thin neck beneath it. But it was the eyes. That was the moment Bill felt fear strike him in the heart like a hammer. There were two large, lidless, glowing orbs staring directly at him. Not reflective, not catching the light. They seemed to generate their own light. They were soft orange, and they were unblinking, unyielding. The creature's long fingers gripped the stones like tendrils, each digit thin and impossibly long, curling over the wall like roots of a tree, trying to pull itself free. Bill gasped, hands tightening on the wheel. The creature didn't move, didn't run. It just watched him. Bill drove home in shock, hands trembling as he sketched what he saw, the drawing that would become iconic. He showed it to his father in near tears. Hours later, across town, 15-year-old John Baxter saw the same creature walking along Miller Hill Road. Tall and spindly, it moved with a strange shifting gait, as if its limbs didn't quite understand how joints were supposed to work. John called out, thinking it might be a person, and the creature froze. It turned its massive head slowly and then slipped into the woods with a fluid gliding motion that made John's blood go cold. And still later that night, Abby Brabham, riding with her boyfriend, saw it herself, crouched by a guardrail, head too large, body too thin, and eyes glowing in the dark of night. Three witnesses, three separate occasions, all on night. And the strangest thing was that all of their drawings matched down to the most minute detail. So whatever walked Dover that night, it wasn't a cat, it wasn't a dog, it wasn't a confused animal, and it certainly was not a child in a costume. It was something else. Something delicate, sleek, silent, but something almost spectral. And like it had only borrowed our world for just a few hours, because it never happened again. For sighting that profound, seen by multiple viewers that could all describe and draw in detail the image of what they encountered, only to have the beast never be seen again. It makes you wonder, is it still walking Dover? Is it still skulking through its streets but learned how to become more stealthy? Did it realize that it could be seen and frighten itself off, seeking a safe harbor, a place to go? Was it nothing more than a misunderstood creature seeking help and solace, but finding only terror in the eyes of everyone that it encountered? It makes you think, what is the story behind the stories? What is it that creeps on our roads at night? Welcome back to the program. Tonight we're discussing strange creature encounters, the things that do make me believe that there is something going on. Because of the type of people that report these stories, because of the way it impacted them and left them scarred, people not necessarily seeking fame or fortune, not seeking to just get their names in the newspapers, people that wanted to avoid criticism and harsh judgment, but yet came forward because their stories terrified them in ways no one could imagine. This next story takes place in 1973 on a humid April night in Enfield, Illinois. Young Greg Garrett was playing near his family's home when he heard a sound behind him, a wet, slapping, almost suction-like noise. He turned. His blood ran cold. His heart seized, screamed. A creature, pale and rubbery looking, crouched low to the ground, only feet from him. It wasn't shaped like anything he recognized, not human, not dog, not reptile. And it stood on three legs, thick and muscular, positioned like a bizarre tripod that held its body suspended unnervingly high. Its eyes glowed an eerie pink, burning bright in the darkness of the night. Before Greg could run, the creature lurched toward him, its strange limbs striking the dirt with a wet, rhythmic thud. Greg bolted, stumbling towards his house, and he felt something tear at his shoes. By the time he reached the door, sobbing and incoherent, his shoes had been shredded. Hours later, just down the road, Henry McDaniel heard a sound at his front porch. Thinking it was a stray, he opened the door with casual annoyance. He froze. There stood the weirdest thing I ever saw, he said. A gray, slimy creature with three legs, two short arms, and those same incandescent pink eyes. And it hissed, a loud, rattling exhale that made Henry stumble backward in fear. He slammed the door, grabbed his pistol, and flung the door open again. The creature leapt, covering 50 feet in just a few monstrous bounds, its three legs pounding the earth like a machine built for distance. Henry called the police, but they didn't believe him until they arrived. Officers found these strange tracks, deep, three-toed impressions, unlike any known animal. And while they were there, two officers swore they saw a strange figure dart near the railroad tracks before vanishing into the brush, uncanny speed. Enfield slept uneasily for weeks. Whatever visited that night wasn't a monster from folklore. It was real. It was physical. And it was terrifyingly fast. And from a three-legged horror in the Midwest, we move west to California, where something impossibly thin walked directly through a man's yard and into his brain. Late one night in Fresno, a man publicly known as Jose sat down to review security footage after hearing strange noises coming from outside. Now, he expected to see the normal culprits, raccoons, maybe a trespasser. Who knows, maybe even nothing. Maybe it was just the wind creating a noise he mistook. But then he hit play. And that's when his life changed. Everything about him fundamentally shifted. He froze. From the left side of the screen, a tall, white figure drifted into view. It didn't walk like a human. It didn't sway like an animal. It glided, impossibly smooth, on what looked like two elongated legs, long and flowing like sheets of fabric, caught in a soft breeze, a summer day clothesline. But there was no torso. There were no arms, just these long legs walking. And that's when a second figure followed, smaller, identical looking, moving with the same slow, eerie grace. Jose felt the hair on his neck begin to rise. He stood in his empty living room watching the tape loop, realizing he had captured the impossible. Investigators have analyzed the footage. Special effects artists tried to replicate the movement, yet every attempt at recreating this footage failed. Years later, deep in the Yosemite National Park, campers awoke to a rustling sound. When they peered out of their tents, they saw two pale figures crossing a moonlit clearing, moving exactly like those in Jose's video. Silent, slow, effortless, like beings constructed of cloth and nothing more than shadow. The campers didn't breathe until the figures faded into the tree line. These weren't hoaxes. They weren't people in costumes. And they moved like nothing from our world. Now from Fresno's silent walkers, we're going to drop into the water where something amphibious started and stared directly into the police officer's headlights. This is the tale of the Loveland Frogman from both 1955 and 1972. The first sighting came in 1955 when a businesswoman driving along the Little Miami River saw a frog-like figure standing upright by the guardrail. But the story exploded 17 years later. On a warm March night in 1972, Officer Mark Matthews was on patrol when he saw what he thought was an injured animal crouched in the road. He approached slowly, shining his flashlight. That's when the creature stood. Officer Mark Matthews froze in terror. The being was about 4 feet tall, with leathery skin, a wide frog-like mouth, and eyes that reflected an eerie pale glow. Its movements were smooth and deliberate, more like a curious person rising to meet him than an animal taking flight. The officer slowly raised his weapon in shock. The creature turned and sprinted toward the guardrail with shocking speed, then vaulted over in a single motion before splashing into the river below. Matthews stood alone on the roadside, his heart pounding, trying to process what he'd just seen. Two sightings that took place decades apart. Two nearly identical descriptions. Something lived in that river. Something amphibious. Something intelligent enough to evade humans. And from the rivers of Ohio, we'll move into the deep water where hundreds of witnesses and one prehistoric historic photograph captured North America's most enduring lake monster. When you think about it, all of these creatures might live around us. How many times have you been out walking in the woods and thought you heard something snap? The leaves crunching behind you. Something moving along the treetops. Maybe something strange swimming along the side of your boat. Something that you can see creating a wake, but doesn't ever breach the surface. I think that this happens to us a lot more often than we care to admit. And how many of us turn a blind eye or turn away? Because if we don't see it, it won't exist. It can't hurt us. It can't harm us if we just ignore what's there. Have you ever had an experience like that? I'd love to hear your story. Email me your tale. Let me know what happened to you and what you were personally witness to. Dave@paranormal60.com. That's the email, dave@paranormal60.com, and we may share it on an upcoming episode of the Paranormal 360. The next story takes place in 1977, Lake Champlain. The lake was calm that summer afternoon, one of those rare, kind of perfect July days where the sky is impossibly blue and the water looks like polished glass. Sandra Mancy and her children were exploring the shoreline, wading through the shallows, skipping stones and laughing. It was peaceful, it was warm, but just another ordinary day. Until it wasn't. Out near the center of the lake, Sandra noticed something strange, a disturbance at first, a ripple where the water should have been still. Well, she thought maybe it was just a log drifting, turning lazily in the current. But then the log rose. Water peeled away from it as it lifted higher and higher, forming into a dark, glistening shape, a long, serpentine neck curled upward, as fluid and flexible as a living hose. And at the top sat a small head, reptilian, narrow, almost delicate, moving with careful intent. Sandra froze. Her children splashed beside her, unaware that something ancient was rising from the depths of Lake Champlain. Sandra slowly backed away, her hands trembling as she reached for her camera. The creature swayed silently, cutting through the water with a slow, deliberate grace, not bobbing, not drifting, but swimming, alive and aware of its surroundings. Sandra snapped one photograph, just one. Her hands were shaking so violently, she nearly dropped the camera. And then instinct surged through her. A primal fear she couldn't explain. She grabbed her children and ran up the bank, not stopping until the creature slid below the water and disappeared completely. The photo she took, the famous Mancy photo, remains one of the most scrutinized cryptid images ever captured. Specialists analyzed the waves, the water depth, the distance, and the same conclusion echoed again and again. Whatever Sandra photographed that day was definitely not a log. It was some type of living creature. And if Lake Champlain holds a serpent of its own, then its cousin to the northwest is even more famous and might even be harder to explain. Let's head to Ogopogo, the serpent of Okanagan Lake. This is from 1968. And it was a quiet day in British Columbia when Art Folden pulled off the road near Okanagan Lake to film his wife and child. The lake stretched out behind them, calm as a mirror. But as he steadied his camera, something far in the distance caught his eye. A wake, long and powerful, cutting across the surface like a knife. Art zoomed in and what he saw made him forget entirely about the family footage that he had intended to capture. A massive dark shape undulated through the water, not flapping fins, not the bobbing of a floating object, but the rhythmic muscular movement of an enormous serpent. Segments of its body breached the surface in a rolling pattern, each rise and fall smooth and coordinated, as if the creature were propelling itself with deep, sinuous strength. Art kept filming. His hands began to shake. His breath became shallow. Whatever this was, it was big, it was fast, and it was real. Marine biologists reviewed the footage. It didn't match other formations. It didn't match wave patterns. It didn't match any known fish or mammal in the region. The lake is deep. It's also dark and icy cold. And something large lived there, large enough to be filmed, large enough to disturb the surface, and large enough to leave scientists without answers. Ogopogo was no legend that day. It was a living creature, moving with purpose through waters older than any settlement on the lake's shores. And from the depth, the icy lakes of Canada, we go to a roaring river in Arkansas where something so massive, so real, forced the state to pass a law in order to protect it. Now, the White River runs through Newport, Arkansas, like a vein. It's this wide, very powerful, unpredictable body of water. And it was along this river back in 1937 that Bramlett Bateman saw something that changed his life forever. Bateman had lived by the river his entire life. He knew its moods, its rhythms, all of its secrets. But on that hot summer day, the water broke in a way he'd never seen. A massive creature surfaced, gray, wrinkled, whale-like in size, but reptilian in shape. Its back was covered in rough patches that looked like barnacles or armored plates. The creature churned the water violently, creating waves so large Bateman feared it would overturn nearby fishing boats. And the word? It spread fast. Dozens of fishermen gathered on the banks, watching in disbelief as the creature breached again and again, long, thick, powerful, before sliding back into the depths with a sound like a collapsing wall of water. Then, in 1971, it came back. Once again, it surfaced, witnessed by entire families, fishermen, and boaters. Reports described a creature between 12 and 30 feet long, with a spined ridge, a flat tail, and movements unmistakably alive. People were so certain of what they saw, so convinced this was not a misidentification, that the Arkansas legislature passed a resolution. Part of the White River became a protected sanctuary for the White River monster, the only protected cryptid habitat in the United States. Not folklore, not a myth, a creature so consistently witnessed that the state government took action to protect it. Amazing. When you lay out all of these stories side by side, the winged giants, the lake serpents, the pale night crawlers, the forest giants, the creatures no biologist ever cataloged, you begin to see a very strange and somewhat unsettling truth. Our planet is older than science, wilder than our textbooks. It's more crowded than our comfort allows. These aren't the ramblings of fringe thinkers. They're reports from police, teachers, soldiers, rangers, pilots, parents, children, people who had nothing to gain by stepping forward, people who saw something that left them changed forever. The universe may hold visitors, but Earth holds its own secrets. Things that slip through tree lines, glide under lake surfaces, watch us from ridgetops, and vanish the moment we try to name them. Are they relics of ancient species, misplaced evolutionary branches, interdimensional travelers, something we have no categories for? We don't know, but the stories persist. The witnesses remain steady, and the phenomena continues, quietly shaping the edges of our understanding. And that's why we explore the dark corners, the deep waters, the lonely skies, and the forgotten roads, because the monsters aren't just legends, my friends. They're here, seen, heard, tracked, and remembered. And maybe, just maybe, waiting for the night, we finally catch up to them. More mysteries remain, more shadows move, and we will cover them here on the Paranormal 360.